Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Think about your favorite smells. I love vanilla and cinnamon or mint, rosemary, stuff that smells good, fresh, maybe delicious.
I just love anything that smells like grapefruit or lemon.
One of my favorite scents is eucalyptus.
My favorite smell is lavender.
But favorite smells tend to be part of a bigger picture of things and people we care about, fond memories. So maybe you love
the smell of fresh tar
because it reminds you of the freshly tarred and perfectly smooth street where you and your childhood friends went rollerblading.
Especially in the summer when it's really hot and the sun is just like boiling that street, you would smell that tar.
I like the smell of firewood and anything toasted, like s'mores, tiki torches. Those smells remind me of situations where I'm around good company.
Or the smell of freshly cut grass brings you back to your first job, mowing lawns.
The gig was simple and satisfying. Better yet, let me spend my days outside.
Smell is a powerful trigger for memories.
Like being in my grandmother's tomato garden in the summertime and remembering her, not just her perfume, but the smell of the tomato leaves as I would help her, you know, weed and pluck things off of the vines. So it seemed that smell always held some special meaning for me in terms of a sensory system that added a really interesting dimension to my life.
That's Pamela Dalton, and she's turned her appreciation of this sensory system into a lifelong research career. She's an olfactory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia.
As it turns out, the olfactory system, which is really part of the oldest part of the brain, is also a part of the limbic system.
That's the part of the brain that supports emotion, behavior, and so on.
Activating an olfactory signal in the cortex also activates the emotional memory system. And that may be why memories that are triggered by odors are not necessarily more accurate or better, but certainly much more emotional. And for that reason, they almost feel like you're being brought back in time to the place where you originally experienced it.
Smell is a pathway to memories. It can deliver a burst of joy. It's also an important alarm system, like, whoa, I smell gas, or something is burning. That milk is sour. But in many ways, it's still a relatively unknown aspect of our experience. It's been studied far less than other senses. This came into much sharper focus during the pandemic, when coronavirus left thousands of people without their sense of smell and without any answers.
It hasn't been until recently where we have seen a virus, a single virus, disrupt olfaction to the extent that the COVID-19 virus has.
On today's episode, our sense of smell and its connection to our health, emotions, and memory. To get started, I wanted to ask Pamela Dalton about some of the basics, like how does smell work? How do we process that information? I have a cup of coffee in front of me right now, so if I stick my nose into it and I smell it, what happens?
Well, hopefully it's a good smell to you.
Yes.
Coffee actually is a very complex aroma. Between 150 and 200 different chemicals might be coming off of that cup of coffee. When you sniff, they'll move into your nose, and hopefully most of them will come to this very special part of your nose, which rests right behind the bridge of your nose, where the odor receptors lie. And those molecules that you sniffed in will attach to specific receptors that are essentially created to bind to those specific molecules. Now, smell is funny. We don't have a one-to-one mapping for, in other words, we don't have a We don't have a coffee receptor. We don't even have a single receptor that responds to one of the 150 chemicals in coffee. But we have receptors that actually can respond to many different chemicals. And we also have those same molecules can bind to many different receptors. And so it's the pattern of activation of all the receptors that actually sends a signal to your brain that tells you what you're smelling.
So my brain is doing some detective work, basically saying, what is this? What is this? Oh, it's this kind of thing?
Very much so. And in fact, if I give you something to smell and you can't see the context, let's say it's coffee odor, but it's in a bottle with no label on it, you actually will have to search through your memory to try to link up the perception of the molecules that make up that that coffee odor with the representation in your brain that says, oh, I'm smelling coffee and I'm not smelling wood smoke or pizza or orange juice. It's a very difficult task.
Yeah, I did that once. It must have been with one of your researchers. And I was shocked how poorly I did because I don't even think I could identify cilantro, which is ridiculous. And I remember thinking like, I know this smell. And I couldn't name it.
We call that the tip of the nose phenomenon, to borrow a phrase from not being able to remember a name or a word. But it's very common. And it's probably because most smells are associated with a context. When we smell coffee, we look around the room and we see who's drinking coffee or is there a pot of coffee, you know, sitting on a warmer somewhere. The same thing is true with almost all odors. When we see the context, when we see the source of it, it's much easier to identify it.
Pamela told me that humans have about 400 different smell receptors in that little patch at the top of the nose. But it seems like some people are better at detecting smells than others. Like I'm thinking, for example, of my mom, who has an incredible sense of smell. Like she could smell people. If I had a friend over, she could smell who was in the house. so there are people
that
who
could be dangerous.
Yes. But there are people who seem to have a really sensitive sense of smell and others not so much, like from baseline.
You're absolutely right. And we're still talking within the normal range of ability. We're not talking about any disorders or anything. But even within the normal range, there is the typical bell curve where some people are just relatively insensitive and some people are highly sensitive. Some of it has to do with age. It's not surprising that very young people, let's say 18 to 25, are some of our most sensitive sniffers if we bring them into the laboratory, particularly young women. Now, some of that may have to do with the fact that their olfactory system is relatively new. We know that the olfactory receptors regenerate over time throughout the lifespan. But probably why they regenerate is because they are exposed to so many things in the external air that could damage them. And so that regeneration is a way of keeping our ability to smell at a pretty constant level. But if you imagine that over time, there could be more and more, you know, effects built up in the system. This may be one of the reasons why, as we move into our sixth, seventh, eighth decade, that our ability to smell does decrease quite a bit.
That's Pamela Dalton. She's an olfactory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Smell is a powerful sense, and now that we're slowly returning to work, to restaurants, movie theaters, we're once again smelling other people. Their cologne, their shampoo, sunscreen, and oh yeah, that overpowering Axe body spray. And sometimes you suddenly get a whiff of something that's really bad, and one immediate thought is often like, ooh, is that me? Did my deodorant fail me? That happened to reporter Grant Hill when he was recently at a party for the first time in ages, living that fully vaccinated life.
Okay, picture a crowded dance floor, you know, thick, sticky air, flashing lights and spilled drinks, and then just the smell of body odor. So I asked my girlfriend Mary to just, you know, give me a quick sniff to see what I smelled like.
Like musty, I chopped down wood all day, and there's also grass stains on my jeans kind of smell.
There's also what?
Grass stains and dirt from like building your own like porch or something.
I never do that.
I know, but it smells like you do, and it's so hot.
Do humans give off smells that make them hot or attractive? This kind of thing happens in different species that pick up molecules through smell that change or affect their behavior. These are called pheromones, and we tend to think of them in the context of attraction, mating, or sex, like a cat picking up another cat that's nearby and in heat. So does this work the same in humans? Grant was intrigued by his girlfriend's comment, and he wanted to find out more.
So, against all odds, Mary thought I smelled good at this sweaty party. And this wasn't the first time she'd mentioned this kind of scent either. The whole thing kind of sounded like a human pheromone. I started to wonder, is what's keeping Mary from moving on to a much better dancer at this party some natural chemical secretion I'm completely unaware of? Or has she simply learned to love my deodorant? To Mary's absolute horror, I asked some other partygoers about the same thing, if there is a scent that attracts them to others.
If I'm attracted to somebody, they have, I don't even know how to describe it, it's like the manly smell. I'm attracted to comfortability, so if I get to know you and you smell like something, then I think I get comfortable with that thing and I'm attracted to that.
So the smell that Steven wears now,
yeah,
I told him to start wearing because Matt wore it all the time and I love the smell.
So you want... So
you're No.
And I always used to wear Chanel Mademoiselle, and my boyfriend always said that his aunt and his mom used to wear that, too. It was like such a familiar scent.
To get to the bottom of this, I spoke with John McLone, a professor of animal science at Texas Tech University. He told me that almost all animal species, from insects to humans, emit similar molecules that could be detected through smell. But how those molecules are interpreted can vary wildly depending on their concentration and the species doing the smelling.
There was a pheromone in a pine beetle that's an aggregation pheromone. Now, what that means is this beetle attacks pine trees, and when it starts feeding, it finds a good pine tree, it puts out an aggregation pheromone, which makes other beetles come to that site and eat that tree. Then, when scientists were studying elephants in Africa, they discovered the same molecule, same exact molecule, was a sex pheromone in the elephant.
Same molecule, very different message. And how and whether it's received very much depends on who's sending it. John says that also comes into play when it comes to humans and pheromones.
Humans have evolved without a heavy reliance on the sense of smell. If you are a species that has developed a sex pheromone, let's say that's the same molecule as an insect, humans will have that same molecule, but they don't perceive that as a sex pheromone in the human.
So while humans often emit the same exact molecules as other animals, it's still unclear at what level humans perceive those molecules and whether we react to them in some hardwired way.
It's difficult to say that humans have pheromones because we have not yet been able to characterize specific molecules that elicit predictable interactions.
That's Jessica Gaby. She's a psychology professor at Middle Tennessee State University, where she researches how the sense of smell influences human interactions.
Humans are really messy creatures to study, right? There's a lot of other factors going on. There's a lot of cognitive factors that might play into the way that you respond to an odor that other animals just don't have. But it certainly seems like we are emitting chemical signals that have social value.
Jessica says that when it comes to smell, context is key. On one hand, there's evidence that our nose is playing a much bigger role in our emotions than we realize. One study suggests the smell of women's tears can quiet feelings of sexual arousal in men. Other research shows sweat can communicate one's level of anxiety.
You are watching a movie, you see a scary thing, someone next to you can pick up on the fact that you are afraid. How did you create that odor so quickly?
People produce their own smells, and then they layer other smells on top, like lotions, perfumes, and deodorants. And those manufactured smells might combine in different ways, depending on a person's diet, and how much deodorant they use, and so on. Jessica has tried to tease those factors apart.
I published a paper a couple years ago where we look specifically, you know, experimentally at how perfume might be impacting body odor.
Jessica and her team gave participants clothing worn by two different people, but sprayed with the same perfume. Participants received a small electrical shock when they smelled one piece of clothing, but not the other.
So what you hope to see is that they eventually develop this sort of expectation of a negative consequence to smelling the one odor, but not the other, right? And so the question was, if the perfume is the thing that matters, then you should not be able to tell the difference between them. But if the underlying individual differences in their body odor are what is important, then you should be able to differentiate them even though they're both wearing the same perfume.
The results showed just that. Participants could decipher which individual's sweat was linked to the electrical shocks despite attempts to mask it. People seem to be responding to something deeper than perfume. But still, this doesn't get us that much closer to understanding if pheromones are at play when it comes to perception.
We know there are individual differences in human body odor, both based on genetic and environmental factors. We don't know if it's that people process these perfumes on their skin differently, so the perfume itself might smell different on me than it smells on you, right? We certainly know anecdotally that that is true. So is it that people are picking up on the differences in the perfume itself, or were they picking up on the underlying body odor differences and just the perfume wasn't sufficiently masking it?
So it seems like humans pick up on something that goes beyond just good smell in a bottle. We're just not quite sure what it is yet. But at least one thing is certain.
Every time I smell it, I'm like, yes, this is it. This is home. I love it.
I'm not changing deodorants anytime soon.
I swear!
That story was reported by Grant Hill. We're talking about smell and, coming up, the ripple effect of losing that critical sense.
Am I going to remember what a piece of garlic tastes like?
That's still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com. The Commonwealth Fund supports The Pulse and reporting on health equity. The Commonwealth Fund, affordable quality healthcare for everyone.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about smell and its connection to our health, memories, and feelings. I was talking to Pamela Dalton. She is an olfactory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. And I asked her about the connection between smell and what we call taste.
And actually, there's a lot of confusion about taste. What most people refer to as taste is actually flavor, which is a combination of not only sweet, salty, bitter, sour, or umami on the tongue, but also all of those volatile molecules, like in your coffee cup, that when you put the coffee in your mouth and swallow it, those molecules get pushed up the back of the throat into the same area where those receptors were when you sniff it, what we call orthonasally, through the front of your nose, through your nostrils. And so it's that combined sensation of the taste, whatever it is, on your tongue, and the odorous stimulation from those volatile molecules that most people refer to as the taste of something, because it's localized to your mouth. And so it's very common to think of that as the taste of coffee, as opposed to the flavor of coffee.
So when your sense of smell is off, your sense of taste is also off.
Sure. Think about having a congested nose from a head cold. What you will probably report to everybody, and even I'll do this, is say, I can't taste anything. And I know very well that I'm still capable of experiencing the sweetness of sugar or the saltiness of a chip. But what I'm missing is all of that contribution that the olfactory system provides to flavor, enjoyment. And so when that happens, you know, we're really limited in what we experience. You can eat three different kinds of berries and you won't be able to tell them apart because they'll all be a certain level of sweetness, but you won't have the volatiles that let you know a strawberry from a raspberry from a blueberry.
What happens when somebody loses their sense of smell? Do we know how that happens, why it happens?
Smell loss can happen for a number of different reasons. It can be temporary or it can be permanent. In some cases, viruses can actually, in addition to producing inflammation and congestion, can also attack the olfactory receptors or the environment that the receptors are in. Another reason you can lose your sense of smell is because of a head trauma. If you have a head injury and a concussion occurs, you can have swelling that presses against the nerve that goes between your nose and your brain, cranial nerve number one, the olfactory nerve. And if that nerve, that's really the pathway that odor information gets to the brain. If that's compromised, then the brain can't smell anything, even if the receptors in the nose are responding properly. And in the cases where it's actually severed, that's a permanent loss of smell, and nothing can be done under those circumstances to date.
Long-term smell loss used to be relatively rare, but that's changed with the pandemic.
Right now, we're seeing almost 70 to 80% of people who contract COVID have some disruption, some partial, some total, to their sense of smell during the acute phase of the virus.
And for some of them, that loss of smell seems to go on and on and on.
Yes, we're looking at somewhere between 10%, possibly 15%, depending on the study, of people who 6 months after they have recovered from the active phase of the infection are still having problems with their ability to smell. Some people cannot smell at all. Some people's taste function is disrupted. Or, and this is even more distressing, some people begin to be able to smell again, but things that they could smell and appreciate now smell bad to them.
It's a condition called parosmia, a distortion of smell. Sakina Benjamin has this. She and I work together. She's the public information coordinator at WHYY. Last summer, she had COVID, but it was a very mild case. And by September, she felt totally fine. No leftover symptoms or anything. But then, a month later, on Halloween, she noticed something really weird.
I stayed inside, I stayed indoors, and I figured I watched like a scary movie. And I had a glass of red wine and some truffle and Parmesan fries. And I thought the fries, I might have cooked them for too long, or they were just like a really bad batch that I picked up from the supermarket. And the wine tasted like awful. And I just figured, like, okay, this was just like a bad trip to the grocery store.
So Sakina didn't think that much of it at first, but then later that night, it happened again.
So that night when I brushed my teeth, the toothpaste just tasted like, it wasn't minty anymore. It was just like a awful, super awful, like, I don't even know what it could have been. Like, rancid meat or just something that was just old and dead. And that was just like my regular toothpaste.
At this point, Sakina thought, okay, something is not right here. So she started searching around online. She found a Facebook group where people described the same exact symptoms after having COVID. Sakina went to see her doctor, but the doctor couldn't really offer much help.
You know, I was scheduled for a visit. I went in and talked to her, and this was like the first time that she was hearing about someone that had these weird symptoms. And the only advice she could give me was like, you know, hopefully this will be over soon. But it wasn't like I was one of many that started to feel this at the time. And that was in maybe late November. So as you can imagine, I didn't have like a really good Thanksgiving either.
Sakina says it's been hard to try to explain to her family what's going on. Like, how do you explain that garlic suddenly smells like rancid meat to you?
And it seemed a little bit of an annoyance at first, or as if I was exaggerating. Like, you know, you just smell something that's just so awful, it reeks.
Sakina loves to cook, but now that so many things don't smell or taste right anymore, she's had to figure out a whole new food repertoire.
It's like my world has sort of like flipped and I have to like rediscover myself in a way and reinvent myself in a way. So I've started eating like vegan products. So I'll eat like vegan chicken patties because they don't have the same taste. And I just cook my vegetables as I would with like butter, olive oil, salt and pepper, and a little bit of cayenne or red pepper flakes, and that's it. So I can't go too crazy or experiment with a lot of seasonings because that's not the thing that I could do anymore.
And if you pick up something like, let's say you take a banana and you smell it, does it smell like a banana? So
now bananas are safe for me. Those are like I have categories of safe foods and bananas have made like the, you know, they've made the list. So an orange, for example, or a tangerine, that is like totally off my list. And since I work from home, oranges and tangerines were like my super favorite thing to snack on while I was working. I can't even have them anywhere near me anymore.
And that's so sad because oranges and tangerines smell so good.
Mm-hmm. I miss it. I truly do.
So if you pick up, if you smell orange cleaner, it also stinks now?
Yeah. It just has a super heavy scent. And I haven't used orange cleaner in months now because that was one of my favorite things to use too.
And can you remember what an orange smells like?
It's sort of, kind of, and that was one of the things that I struggled with is like, am I going to remember what a piece of garlic tastes like or how it feels to eat like an onion ring and, you know, those kinds of things, or how it feels to like peel a tangerine and just snack on it. Sadly for me, it's like those things I guess I took for granted because I can't have those little tiny moments of joy and experience that anymore.
I asked smell researcher Pamela Dalton about this, and she said there are a couple of different theories in terms of why this happens.
The one that probably has the most evidence in favor of it is that in order for smell to occur, those receptors in the nose have to send their message to the next way station in the brain called the olfactory bulb. Now, the olfactory bulb is organized in terms of if this receptor makes a connection with this cell in the bulb, it will result in this perception to the brain.
Pamela says there have been animal studies that found that after a disruption in the sense of smell, the receptors were regenerating, but their messages seemed to travel to the wrong places.
This is possibly what is happening with humans, that essentially the mapping has gotten lost. And so these receptors are connecting to the bulb and the brain is experiencing odor, but it's experiencing the wrong odor. Now, that's a really neat, you know, way of thinking about it because it makes a lot of sense. One of the things we don't understand is that the connections or the perceptions aren't random. They tend to all be unpleasant, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like all of a sudden you're smelling chocolate and it smells like a rose, or you're smelling, you know, your coffee and it smells like peanut butter, which would be okay. It would be disturbing, but it would not be a bad odor. But it seems like all of the odors that occur that are distortion odors are really unpleasant. They smell like garbage or gasoline or dog poop. And so one wonders why, if the system isn't working well, would all odors smell bad? Well, maybe that's the default. If you can't figure out what you're smelling, you should assume everything is potentially bad for you and stay away from it. So we really don't know exactly what's happening. We do think there's some form of a wrong mapping occurring, but why everything should smell bad as opposed to just smell randomly good or bad, we don't have an explanation for that.
And do we have anything that people could do or try if this is happening?
It turns out that the only thing that is recommended for post-viral smell loss or even post-viral distortions is something called smell training. And all it is it really involves taking four odorants, maybe six odorants, generally people use four, and twice a day, really intently try to smell them and associate them in your mind with what they smelled like beforehand. Whether you can smell them or whether you cannot smell them at all, or whether you smell them and they don't smell like what they should, what you're trying to do is really reestablish that connection between the molecules that are coming into your nose and the brain experience, the perception that they should have actually produced based on your prior memory.
Sakina has tried smell training. She has essential oils like lavender, and she says it's helped a little bit. Like, she gets little flashes of smell.
Something will come, and then it'll, like, disappear as quick as it got to me.
So you're getting a whiff of...
Just a whiff, and it's like, oh, gosh, that smells good, and it's gone, like, within a blink of an eye.
But it seems like your brain wants to just wants it back.
Like. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like my brain is like struggling to understand, like that olfactory sense is like, you know, struggling to heal itself and, you know, remember, okay, like this is what garlic is like. This is like that savory, pungent thing that you used to love. And it's like, where is it? Like, I can't seem to figure out or find it.
Sakina smelled that bit of garlic right after she got her COVID vaccine.
I went into my spice cabinet and it's like the onion powder and a garlic salt, the garlic powder, they're all in the back. And I said, you know what? This was like a few days after I got the first shot. I said, let me just take a whiff of it and see if it comes back. And it did, but it was only for a split second. And it was like, this is it. Mm. And it went away so fast. I have like struggled with this, and it's like now I'm starting to feel a little bit hopeful, but I only credit that to talking to other people that are going through the same thing. It wasn't like that before, where it's like I'm the only one. I feel like I'm in this dark hole and I cannot get out. And it's like, you're like this over food and things to smell and things to taste, but that's a huge part of my life.
And it's a big part of enjoyment.
Yeah.
And when that's taken from you, I mean, it is one of our senses. And I think sometimes we don't think of taste and smell like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And if I had to lose one, I would pick that one. But it's one way in which we experience the world.
Yeah, yeah. And I just think about, like, you know, like trips that I've been on where I was able to enjoy myself and, like, use, smell fruits that were from different places and just eat exotic meals. And it's like, oh, if I take a trip again, I won't be able to do that.
That's Sakina Benjamin. She's had parosmia since October of last year. Since our conversation, she has enrolled in a parosmia study at the Monell Chemical Senses Lab in Philadelphia. Pamela Dalton says that although it's hard, people like Sakina should stick with the smell training. Recovery can happen even months or years later. Coming up, imagine you're an astronaut. You've beaten out hundreds of other people to make it to space. You're in your fancy suit, you're bouncing around in the spaceship, and it stinks in there.
If you can imagine in space, you can't open a window, and if there's a stinky situation in the bathroom, it's close quarters, so there's not much fresh air to air things out.
What can be done to reduce those foul smells? We'll visit NASA's Smell Lab. That's still to come on The Pulse.
Behavior. behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about the science of smell with Pamela Dalton. She's an olfactory scientist at the Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Pamela says our sense of smell evolved as an alarm system, bringing information from a distance.
Odors can travel quite far from their source, given the right environmental conditions. And so there's always been this intuition that smell was a danger sensor at first from evolution. And now there's even some good research showing that when we experience a smell, before we decide that it's safe, we essentially process it as a potential danger. It alarms us. The amygdala lights up. Then, given enough time, we can evaluate the context that we're in and decide whether that smell is dangerous or it's, you know, something in the environment that has been there and we know is fine. So being able to detect things like spoiled food, particularly a lot of the sulfur compounds, which are organic decomposition, can tell you if there's a dead animal or a dead body or spoiled food in the environment. And I think the pleasure, the ability to find food based on smell and the pleasure we get from sense evolved much later.
So danger first.
Danger first. And it's still what the olfactory system does best.
So even if I smell coffee brewing somewhere for a millisecond, my brain might process that as something that could be dangerous.
That's the evidence, yes, that the initial response to the brain is alert, vigilance. This could be something dangerous. And then given enough time, you put that together with the context you're in. You walk in there and expect to smell coffee. Even a familiar smell in an environment where it's unexpected is going to cause you to be vigilant. Let's say you walk into your home and no one is home and you haven't brewed coffee since the morning. You walk into your home and you smell coffee brewing, fresh coffee brewing. You're going to be on alert. Someone's there brewing coffee that you didn't expect, right?
That's smell researcher Pamela Dalton from the Monell Chemical Senses Center. Researching smell often involves people who come into the lab and put their noses to work. Julio Padilla works in a smell lab, and when he's interviewing participants who want to be sniffers, you know, to sniff out the presence or strength of different smells, he gives them what they call the 10-bottle test.
10 bottles, three of them are blanks, which is just distilled water with no smell, and seven others have smell.
It's sort of your basic menu of strong scents, from floral and minty to pungent and putrid, all of which come in small glass bottles labeled only with numbers.
And they have to identify the blanks, which is the most important part, and they also need to be able to distinguish between the seven other smells.
If they can do that, it means their noses are good for lab-level sniffing. Julio gave us a little demo.
All right, so I'll start with one. I'm not getting a smell. Wait, no. Maybe floral.
The next one is hard to tell, too. So for the third one, Julio takes a deep sniff.
Oh, shouldn't have done that. So that one's definitely putrid.
As it turns out, this is just the tip of a very stinky iceberg. The Smell Lab is part of NASA's White Sands Test Facility in New Mexico. And their job is to sniff out some of the most horrible smells you can imagine to help NASA engineers figure out how to contain them. We're talking about smells that are disgusting just to hear about. So this is your listener warning if you have a weak stomach or if you're in the middle of eating. Liz Tung takes it from here.
I've always loved imagining what it must be like going into space, doing somersaults in zero gravity, seeing the Earth spinning just outside your window, floating among the stars. But one thing I never thought to imagine was the smell. Here's the Odor Lab's manager, Susanna Tapia Harper.
Especially space vehicles that have been in use for a long period of time, there have been reports that those kind of smell like locker rooms.
At first, I thought it was kind of weird that NASA had a lab dedicated just to smell. But once you start thinking about it, it makes a lot of sense. On one of these missions, you might have, say, half a dozen astronauts, all crammed into what is essentially a sealed metal tube. A sealed metal tube that, in addition to being their workplace, is also where they eat, where they exercise, and yes, where they do their business.
If you can imagine in space, you can't open a window. And if there's a stinky situation in the bathroom, it's close quarters, so there's not much fresh air to air things out.
The source of some smells, like the kitchen trash, can at least be tied up in a bag. But that's not the case for all of the smells.
Yes, so there are those smells like sweat and farts that aren't able to be contained, and those do start to accumulate over time.
One of the main goals of the Odor Lab is helping engineers figure out how to minimize the stink, which Susanna says is important for a couple reasons.
We really want our astronauts to be able to focus on their job. If you can imagine, if you had to do your homework in a nasty bathroom, it would be hard to concentrate. So that's the kind of situation we want to avoid for our astronauts.
But it's not just about focus or quality of life. Susanna says serious stench can even be a safety issue.
If an emergency occurs on any of our space vehicles, like a fire or an ammonia leak, we want our astronauts to be able to have a very sensitive sense of smell so they can detect it immediately and then fix that problem without delay.
Believe it or not, all of this is a crucial part of the next big step in space exploration, namely manned long-range missions. We're talking the kind of trips that could finally bring humans to Mars, which means managing smells not for days or for weeks, but for months, maybe even as long as a year. So NASA tasked some of its engineers with coming up with a new trash bag, one that has a superior ability to stop stench. Susanna remembers testing the prototype. It was kind of hard to forget.
In that test, we included things like food trash, moldy food trash that we allowed to mold over an extended period of time. We also evaluated, you know, dirty wipes and towels. But that test also included things like pee, like fecal waste in dirty diapers, because our astronauts in some cases don't have access to a bathroom and do have to wear some diapers that eventually get dirty, and also vomit. So we put all those lovely things inside of one large trash bag and let it ferment for an extended period of time, and took whiffs of that over a couple months to see how well the trash bag could contain those stinky odors.
It wasn't totally relevant, but I had to know. Where exactly did these samples come from?
So we actually had, for that test, astronaut food used, and we had volunteers eat the food and then help to introduce their saliva and bacteria into the food packages, and then package them in the exact way that the astronauts might. So we actually got astronaut directions on how they package their food trash to try to make it as tightly sealed as possible. And then we let that sit around for a long period of time and mold. As for the collection of pee and fecal waste, what we did is we actually received astronaut diapers. They shipped those to us, and we had volunteers wear those and help collect their morning waste so that we could introduce it into the trash bag.
For extra scientific precision, they even weighed the diapers beforehand.
And then we weighed the dirty diaper afterwards so we could quantify how much waste they had provided.
So they gather this horrendous mix of trash and bodily fluids, and they seal it up in one of these specially designed garbage bags. After that, they place the bags inside airtight metallic chambers designed to catch any smells that might leak out of the bags. And just to make things extra gross, they actually heated the trash up.
And the reason we heat it is that we also want to replicate the temperature conditions that might be seen in actual flight. And so for previous tests, we've actually fluctuated the temperature over time to simulate different temperatures that the trash may see. Because I think, as we all know, when it's hotter, things get stinkier. And so we want to simulate that in our actual odor test as well.
So they wait a few weeks, and then once the trash is nice and ripe, they crack open the chamber to see how it smelled. But the sniffers don't just stick their noses in. Oh no. Julio Padilla told me the way they do it is they attach these syringes to masks that fit snugly around the sniffers' faces. They then use the syringe to draw some of the air from the metal chamber.
And then administer the 30 cc's directly into the face of our odor panel members. And we count down from three, that way they're ready to breathe and smell. And then I go ahead and just use a plunger to administer the gas to their face, directly to their nose.
Now at this point, it's the sniffer's job to rate the smell according to different categories.
They rate it from 0 to 4, and they also provide a general assessment of the odor, whether it was neutral, pleasant, irritating, or revolting.
They're also asked to describe how the odor is affecting them.
For example, if you smelled, let's say, the vomit and the bag didn't contain it, you would probably gag. So that would be one of the effects of the sniff.
I know this is all necessary science, but that just sounds like the most revolting thing. Like a like a container full of like heated trash. I applaud your sniffers.
They're definitely brave people. You never know what that first sniff is gonna bring.
Has anybody ever thrown up?
Luckily, I have not had anybody throw up on me.
Now, that may be partly because the trash bags were doing their job, keeping all these horrible smells in. But Susanna remembers past tests where the sniffers weren't so lucky.
I know that we had a lot of people reporting that they were gagging and that they had to have the trash can right next to them because they weren't sure if they were going to make it to the bathroom after those smells.
Well, such is the price of progress. Though I couldn't help but wonder. It seems like every few months there is a new story about NASA deploying incredible new technology. Artificial intelligence that can repair ships, probes venturing to Jupiter, even smart unmanned rovers exploring the surface of Mars. So why can't they just design a trash-sniffing robot? I asked Susanna that question.
There are e-noses that have been developed to try to help characterize smells, but really, despite all the best efforts to evaluate technologically what smells are, really the human sense of smell is still far superior. We have been equipped with an incredibly sensitive detector in our nose, more sensitive than anything that we've been able to replicate in our technology.
Humans 1, robots 0. It's not always pleasant being equipped with a powerful smell detector, but hey, with great power comes great responsibility.
That story was reported by Liz Tong. During my conversation with olfactory researcher Pamela Dalton, she mentioned that smell is under-researched. There's still so much we don't know. And I wonder if that might change now in light of the pandemic.
I think, unfortunately, this pandemic has been a very positive thing for olfactory research in many ways. Post-viral smell loss has been something of an under-researched problem, largely because it could have been caused by many different types of viruses in the past. ENTs might get a couple of patients a year to be able to study and to pull into a study. But nowhere near the millions of people who have lost their sense of smell acutely, as well as the millions or so that may have long-term loss. And so this provides us an unparalleled opportunity to understand what is happening to the olfactory system, what can promote recovery, and gives us lots of individuals to work with, unfortunately, who we can learn from.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Hannah Fulmer is our intern. Sojourner Ahebe is our health equity fellow. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.